Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, April 4th, 2018. More than 20 South Sudanese are deported from the United States.
We have received 24 South Sudanese deported from the USA. Yeah, and then with the accompanying documents, we got that they are actually charged with some criminal activities. Some are drugs, some are violence, and so on.
And Uganda reconsiders its refugee policy.
We are going to reorganize them to the extent that there will be settlement on just one side of the camp. And then three quarters of the camp should be used for extensive agriculture.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. More than 20 South Sudanese men who had been living in the United States were deported back to South Sudan last weekend. The deportees were charged with several criminal offenses committed in various U.S. cities. The deportees say they are facing a lot of challenges as they begin a new life in South Sudan. But authorities in Juba say the government will take care of the young men. Manyang David Mayar reports for VOA from Juba.
31-year-old Mabura Kau traveled to the United States as a refugee at the age of 14 in 2001. He says America molded him into a different person, and now he feels like a victim of peer pressure.
I went as a regular man from South Sudan, innocent man that want a better life for himself. But America taught me to be a criminal. You know, when I was in high school, somebody told me, this is a true story, somebody told me, smoke with me. I said, I don't smoke mabango. I go to school, that's it. You know, 2 years later, I see me smoking bango. They tell me, because America, they influenced me. You know, it's a criminal state.
Hakau is one of the 24 South Sudanese citizens deported back to their home country from the United States last Friday. Some of the men were charged with rape, taking part in violence activities and other criminal offenses. Upon their arrival at Juba International Airport, officers with the Ministry of Interior's Department of Criminal Investigation promptly arrested Hakau and the 23 other deportees. Police spokesman Daniel Justin confirms the deportees are in police custody in the capital.
We have received 24 South Sudanese deported from the USA. Yeah, and then with the accompanying documents, we got that they are actually charged with some criminal activities. Some are drugs, some are violence, and so on.
Justin says the police is working to connect the deportees with their relatives. He says some of the deportees have been taken already, but others are still under police custody. Hakau claims they were picked up in Hartford, beaten, and jailed for a period of between 4 months and 1 year before being deported. He claims they were handcuffed and forced to board a plane without their belongings. Despite his abrupt departure, Hakau says he has found memories of the glittering East Coast city of Hartford, Connecticut, near New York City.
I'm used to being in America, good life. When I come, I went almost crazy, you know. They tell us they're going to give us 10,000. We didn't get not even 1,000. Some of my boys stayed behind because they were scared of the situation. I'm the real Sudanese. I say I'm going back home. If that's what America wants, I'll take it back. It was embarrassing to tell local people I come from America with no money for America. I have nowhere to sleep, nowhere to eat. You know, this America we're supposed to respect and send us back like this.
The South Sudanese American says he worked as a motor mechanic while living in the U.S. He says he wanted U.S. authorities to give him 1 year to hand some money before being sent back to South Sudan. His request was not granted by U.S. Homeland Security authorities. It is not clear if any of the deportees had dual U.S. South Sudanese citizenship. Hakau says he hopes to pick up where he left off in America and earn a living as an auto mechanic in South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Manyang David Mayar. in Juba.
The UN Refugee Agency says it regrets Israel's decision to cancel an agreement to resettle thousands of Eritrean and Sudanese asylum seekers. The UN says there is hope that a solution still can be found. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
There are about 39,000 Eritrean and Sudanese asylum seekers in Israel, most of them living in poor neighborhoods of Tel Aviv. On Monday, Israel and the UN Refugee Agency announced an agreement to send some of the refugees to Western countries, while allowing others to remain in Israel under temporary visas and find jobs. This elicited a howl of protest from right-wing allies of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who consider the Africans illegal immigrants. Netanyahu canceled the agreement the next day. Earlier, Israel said it would give the refugees a choice: accept relocation to African countries or face extended time in jail. Several NGOs opposed to that took their case to Israel's Supreme Court, which ruled in favor of the refugees and froze the policy. What happens next, says UN Refugee Agency spokesman William Spindler, is up in the air.
We are back to square one, if you like. The controversial policy of sending these people to countries in Africa has been frozen by the High Court in Israel. The countries that were supposed to take them have denied that they are part of these agreements.
Spindler says the UNHCR's offer to work with the Israeli government still stands. He says the agreement canceled this week would provide a solution for the Africans who are in need of protection from war and persecution. At the same time, he says it would meet the concerns of the local Israeli communities hosting them. Spindler says the policy of sending refugees to Africa, reportedly to Uganda and Rwanda, was widely criticized because it was not in the best interest of the refugees.
Once the refugees arrive there, they find very little possibility to integrate. Many of them don't feel safe there. And then they continue in long, dangerous routes, risking their lives. Once again, because many of them went through terrible ordeals before they arrived in Israel. So once again, they will be on the move.
However, Spindler says the current situation is not tenable, and ultimately, Israel and the UNHCR must find a way out of this impasse. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still on refugee issues, in neighboring Uganda, the refugee population is more than 1.4 million. And it is growing because of the conflict in South Sudan and Congo. The influx is forcing Uganda to rethink its many years policy of allocating plots of land to refugees to live on and farm. Halima Athumani reports from Changwale Refugee Settlement in western Uganda.
The Congolese refugees arrive on the Ugandan side of Lake Albert aboard rickety boats. More than 60,000 have come since the start of the year. They are fleeing a fresh wave of communal violence in the northeastern DRC. Now, the Changwali refugee settlement is growing crowded. Nzeimane Emmanuel fled to Uganda in 2014. The government gave him use of a 9-by-9-meter plot of land in Changwali. The recent violence in Congo forced his family to join him. He says, we used to farm, but now the gardens have been reduced. Because of the influx, they told us we can't continue farming. Uganda began allocating land to refugees in the early 1960s. Ownership remains with the government or host communities, but refugees use the plots for free, building small homes of mud and wattle and cultivating small gardens. The goal is to make refugees self-reliant and able to feed themselves. But amid the influx from Congo, the government says it must redesign some settlements, including Changwali. Muse Echweru is Uganda's Minister for Relief, Disaster Management and Refugees.
So that refugees will not be scattered through the camp like we have to date handled. We are going to reorganize them to the extent that there will be settlement on just one side of the camp. And then 3/4 of the camp should be used for extensive agriculture.
The refugee influx from Congo over the past 3 months has already exceeded the UN's projection for all of 2018, and more are expected. But a potentially bigger challenge remains in northern Uganda. That part of the country is home to more than 1 million South Sudanese refugees, most of whom have arrived since 2016. The influx has created tension with locals who feel the refugees get better treatment than they do. Gilbert Olanya is a member of National Parliament from northern Uganda.
You find the citizen of this country is going angry. There's no food, but refugees are being supplied with enough food. No proper medical services, but in the refugees' camp, there are good medical services. No water supply, but in the camp, there are clean water. Therefore, we really feel the government is not doing much for the local people who have given their land to the refugees to settle in.
Some communities have demanded they also get priority for jobs with aid groups serving the refugees. Frustrations have flared in recent months. There have been reports of local residents assaulting refugees, attempting to block access for aid groups or banning the group's vehicles. Halima Athmani for VA News, Changwali, Uganda.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a group of lawyers open up shop for people living in disputed Abyei territory. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what makes a relationship strong?
The only thing is trusting one another. When you trust someone, you will not think negative of your partner.
Communication. The moment you communicate, everything is going to be sorted. Because most marriages always break out because of little communication among the spouses.
Trust and faith. When, for example, if I'm in a relationship, I would suggest, it's important for your partner to trust you and have faith in you.
Relationship can be strong when you understand yourself, you have unity and you work together, and you also have common activities you do together so that you can share the relationship. The relationship will be stronger.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Some young lawyers from the disputed Abyei area have established an office in the town to offer legal services to residents. Two lawyers who graduated from the University of Juba in 2014 say they came to Abyei as part of their efforts to help develop the area. Some Abyei residents say the presence of the lawyers has helped them to know their rights. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
Sitting in his small office made up of wood, bamboo and grass in Abyei's Mulmul market, Kwal War Alei says he is rewarding to provide legal services to his own people. Speaking in Arabic, War says legal awareness is very low among residents who lives in a town claimed by both Sudan and South Sudan.
I have been away from my area for studies, and it is important for me to come back to the area and offer some services to the community through what I have acquired outside. That is why I decided to come back and open this office in Abyei and offer legal service and contribute to the development of the area.
War says this past year, his office helped 120 clients who sought legal advice. He says he will continue to provide legal assistance to residents by creating awareness in disputed over property, cattle grazing, rape, inheritance and other legal issues.
There are some of them who do not know the roles of a lawyer, and we are explaining that to them. We also try to tell them steps of how to file cases in the court, educate them on how to use legal means than to take the law into their hands. At least some progress is there.
Ward says his clients pay anywhere from 1,000 South Sudanese pounds on up, depending on the case. Luel Mayan Kwal is another legal advocate who works with War in Mulmul Market. Speaking in Arabic, Mayan says he hopes their presence in the area will reduce revenge attacks among communities. He says If people in every community are able to understand and respect the law and no longer engage in revenge attacks over cattle or property, development could easily take place in
Abia.
Any country or a society that respects the law and order will be regarded as developed society. If we all respect the law, that means we will be respecting rights of others, and there will be less troubles among communities. As such, people will focus on other development projects.
A civil code was established in Abia in 2015 by the area civil administration to help resolve disputes among communities in the area. Some residents say they no longer travel to Turalei, Kwajok, nor Wao to seek legal redress. Abia resident Mawien Ujang Maper says he thanks the help of the legal advocates who set up shop in Abia. He now knows the importance of lawyers in court procedures. Speaking in Arabic, Ujang says the Abia civil administration should also establish prison service in the area to keep criminals behind bars.
When a criminal is tried and charged in a court of law, he or she is supposed to be taken to the prison. This is what we don't have it here in Abia. The work of the police is not to keep criminals, but only to arrest and take them to court of law. But after that, prison service is to take over.
Kwal Alor Kwal is the head of the Abia Civil Administration. He says criminals convicted in Abia Civil Court are taken to Wao Central Prison. He says many services not afforded in Abia due to the disputed status of the area. Kwal says he hopes President Salva Kiir Mayardit and his Sudanese counterpart Omar al-Bashir will resolve their standoff over the status of the area.
There is a need for the final status to be Abia to be determined, because people of Abia have been suffering since almost 11 years now without services, without health services, educational services, education services, and other things, other necessary services.
Kwal says Abia's population remains at about 160,000 people. Under the UN Security Council Resolution 1990 of June 2011, the Abia area shall be demilitarized from any forces other than UNISFA and the Abia Police Service. The resolution also charges the interim forces with facilitating the delivery of humanitarian aid and the free movement of relief workers in and around Abia. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Yaounde, where Cameroon's military has freed 18 people, including 12 European tourists, seized by armed separatists in the English-speaking regions. Dozens are still in captivity. Last week, a Tunisian was killed in another operation in which four engineers were freed. Embassies are cautioning their nationals against traveling to the English-speaking regions of Cameroon. Muki Edwin Kinzeka has this report for VOA from Yaounde.
12 of the 18 former hostages looked tired, hungry and unkempt as they arrived in Yaounde Tuesday. They refused to grant interviews. Communications Minister Issa Chiruma says the 7 Swiss nationals and 5 Italians were freed from the bushes of Manyu, an administrative unit on Cameroon's southwestern border with Nigeria, after a battle between Cameroon government troops and armed separatists. Chiruma says local residents told the military where the hostages had been taken to.
Les 12 touristes sont parmi nous grâce à la collaboration.
He says the 12 tourists regained their freedom thanks to the collaboration between the population, self-defense groups and forces of law and order. He says many hostage takers were neutralized. Chiruma said the tourists were visiting a twin lake in the locality of Ngute when armed men seized their vehicle and held them hostage for several days. After they were freed, the tourists were taken to a hospital for medical care, from where they will be handed over to their embassies for return travel formalities. 6 municipal councillors who were kidnapped in the northwest while going to vote in the country's senatorial election have also been freed. The separatists had warned them not to vote, saying that English-speaking Cameroon was now an independent country called Ambazonia and will not accept any election organized by a foreign country. Last week, a Tunisian was killed in another operation in Manyo Division in which four engineers were freed. Cameroon says at least a dozen other people, including two senior state officials, are still being held hostage by the separatists. Didier Bajek, a spokesperson for the Cameroon military, says allegations the military commits atrocities while fighting separatists are lies that should not discourage the population from working with them.
La réalité de ce théâtre est que nos forces font preuve de sang-froid, elles restent professionnelles.
He says the military has remained professional, even though the terrorists are using social media to accuse them of committing atrocities. He says they will fight until all Cameroon is free and all those held hostage released. Tensions started in Cameroon in 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers went on strike to protest what they called the overbearing use of French. The government says hundreds of people, including 30 policemen and soldiers, have been killed this year. Embassies in Cameroon have been cautioning their nationals against traveling to the English-speaking regions. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
From Yaoundé, we come back to South Sudan, where members of the Padang community are speaking out against a report published by the Sentry, which says the Padang funded the government, the Padang funded by the government, have been engaging in attacks against civilians and have committed other atrocities in Upper Nile. As INBO reports, community members are questioning the findings of the report.
The Padang community in South Sudan is mentioned 14 times, including 3 times in the footnotes of the Sentry's investigative report published last month. The report argues the leaders in South Sudan pocketed the country's oil wealth and terrorized civilians in the process using an ethnic militia made up of Padang Dinka. But Mayik Denkir, deputy chairperson of the Padang community in North America, says the report is inaccurate.
We did not receive any money. The oil is now in Padang areas, and we have been suffering for a long period of time. Let me give you the example of oil pollution in Padang areas. Now people are dying. The new babies are born with the deformities and all kind of things. And if we have those money, why do we have to fight instead of helping our people? This is false and it is baseless.
The Sentry says it has reviewed documents that show former Petroleum Minister Stephen Diu Dao, who is also from Padang, of supplying money to Padang Dinka militia groups. It says the Padang militia, initially established to protect Paloch oil fields, has become central actors in South Sudan's civil war around the time they began receiving financial support directly from the country's National Security Service. An email between Geth Abraham Dawson, a senior aide to Diu Dao, and individuals stationed at the Paloch oil fields indicate that the Ministry of Petroleum played a role in supplying the Padang Dinka militia over a 10-month period between September 2014 and July 2015, according to the report. Documents reviewed by the Sentry also show a payment of over $1 million worth of food for the White Army in the Upper Nile, where it says Padang militias operate, as well as a payment to militia commander Tor Ajut Deng. But Deng says that is also not true.
And we condemn this in a very strong term possible, because the Sentry have to apologize to Padang communities across South Sudan. We are the victim of this war, and I believe you are aware of what is going on. Let me give you the example of General Johnson Oloing. He declared the war against Padang when he was interviewed in Southern Sudan TV. And he was claiming that the reason he took army was because Padang is grabbing the land from Western Nile and from Eastern Nile. So the Western Nile is like, there is a certain place called Wunkur, and in northern Upper Nile, which is Sonokur and Biela, they are claiming some areas over there. And this guy took military hardware of the SPLA and they use them against Padang, and I think you are aware of that one. We don't see their report.
The UN panel of experts on South Sudan has produced similar findings. In a report published in January 2016, the panel cited multiple sources who said the Dinka Padang community received small arms and ammunition through South Sudan's Internal Security Bureau, a move that was authorized by then-Finance Minister Stephen Dudow. Wilson Thone, another elected member of the Padang community in the U.S., says his community has been victimized by the war.
We don't have protection force or protected force or community police because the oil areas of the force that has been initiated by the government, and I believe there is a division that protecting that force, I mean protecting that oil facilities in Foloi and even in Unity State. But the one that is functioning now is the main oil in Foloi, but they are protection force.
An Amnesty International report says their researchers documented several killings of civilians by government forces and Dinka militias during an offensive that occurred in April last year. Amnesty says tens of thousands of civilians in the Upper Nile were forcibly displaced in the first 5 months of 2017. The report put the blame on government forces who burned, shelled, and looted homes. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. 24 South Sudanese men who had been living in the U.S. were deported back to South Sudan this past weekend. The deportees were charged with several criminal offenses. The men say they're facing many challenges as they begin a new life in South Sudan, but authorities in Juba say the government will help take care of them. 31-year-old Mabior Aku traveled to the U.S. as a refugee at the age of 14. He says America molded him into a different person, and now he feels like a victim of peer pressure. In Uganda, the parliament has approved a government request to pay off a debt owed to Ugandan traders by the government of South Sudan. According to the deal, South Sudan is expected to pay back the loan with interest when it stabilizes. For almost 8 years, a number of Ugandan traders who supplied goods and services to the government have been waiting for compensation for outstanding arrears totaling $41 million. And finally, some young lawyers from the disputed area of Abyei have set up an office in the town to provide legal services to residents. Two lawyers who graduated from the University of Juba say they came to Abyei to help develop the area. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Mudongo by Paloso and Sheba.
Well, it's Paloso and Sheba. Paloso, yeah.
We have been listening to Paloso and Sheba with the song Mudongo. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.